Hi guys, good morning, afternoon, night, evening, wherever you're listening to this podcast, and welcome back to Teachable Psych. My name is Sarah Jang, your host, and this week's episode features guest Dr. Richard Hunter from the University of Massachusetts Boston. In this episode, we talk about how stressful or traumatic life events alter not only the course of our lives, but the very structure and function of our brains as well. Now, I hope you guys enjoy this episode, and I'll see you at the end.
I'm Dr. Richard Hunter. I'm an associate professor of psychology and the director of the Developmental and Brain Sciences Program at the University of Massachusetts Boston. I've been a neuroscientist, I guess, for 25-plus years now, depending on how you measure that. And I study the neurobiology of stress, I guess, is sort of the simplest one-sentence definition of the things that I do research-wise.
Awesome. And how exactly did you get started in neuroscience, or what pushed you to continue this field for so long?
Well, I came by it honest. My father was a neurologist, and so I'm one of the very weird people who actually could play with plastic brains and actual human skulls as a child, because Dad had those floating around his office. Yeah, I'm weird. I recognize it, but a lot of us are in the sciences. But so I had a neurology background. But actually, initially, in college, I wasn't very interested. I was much more interested in medieval history. And so that's the major I started college with. And then part of the way through, I kind of realized that, like, I'm not really good with the language side of this, or I'm not as good as I would like to be with, you know, learning Old English and Latin and stuff. But I really like biology. My mom was a biochemist, and my dad, obviously, was a doctor. So there's a lot of biology in the family and chemistry. And so I sort of drifted out of history and into biology, and that wound up being my major when I finished college at University of Texas, and really loved it. You know, I was very fortunate to be at Texas for that, because they made you take a very broad biology curriculum. So I had to take field ecology, experimental lab class, which was wonderful, because we, you know, would figure out how to, like, measure all the species in 1 hectare plot, or all around leaf cutter ants, which built these huge mounds in Texas. You know, they're like 6 foot tall mounds, which was amazing to me as someone from the East Coast, where we don't have ants that are, well, we have fire ants, but they don't build like leaf cutters do. And, you know, microbiology and zoology, and, you know, and just, you know, I took a class on plant cell culture, you know, and one on bacteriophages, which was one of my favorite classes ever, which, again, not intuitively obvious that would be a really fun class, but I took it from somebody who is a world-renowned expert in it. He just really loved them, and I really loved the systems, you know, that turned out to be really important in my later career, just all the different information systems that the viruses use to transmit information between themselves and bacteria and other stuff like that, and the really clear genetic thinking that led to. So, but I wound up, I did some work as an undergraduate in George Bittner's lab, and he was someone who's very involved in kind of like axonal sealing and regeneration and things like that, and a fairly famous neuroscientist at the time. I didn't really accomplish much as an undergraduate. I wasn't particularly focused at that point in time, but I realized something like this is what I wanted to do, and I wound up moving back home to Georgia and getting a job in a lab at what was then Yerkes National Primate Center, working for Michael Kubar, basically screening potential drugs to treat cocaine addiction. So I was running a whole bunch of tubes every day, you know, doing radioligand binding for things that interact with dopamine transporter and serotonin transporter and so forth and so on. Wound up just doing my PhD in his lab, which turned out to be a really good time to do a PhD in neuroscience at Emory, which was the institution that Yerkes was a part of, because he got to work in Larry Young's lab, who recently passed away, but is famous for establishing the molecular basis of basically pair bonding, or love, I guess, in neuroscience sense. You know, I worked with Tom Ensel, who was later the director of the National Institute of Mental Health, and a whole bunch of other people. And again, like, I feel like I've been really lucky in my training, that I just sort of, in spite of myself, wound up in places where people were doing really cool things and they let me hang out. And then wound up from there in Bruce McEwen's laboratory at the Rockefeller Institute in New York, or Rockefeller University in New York. And that was also wonderful. Postdoc, and then I finally got a real job, and I've been at UMass for about 10 years. So, that's my story.
That sounds like a lot of intensive research, but I'm glad you got to meet all those amazing people to guide you through it.
Yeah, I feel very blessed that way. You know, Mike was a wonderful mentor, and then Bruce McEwen, and I also worked with Don Pfaff and Dave Alice was at Rockefeller. All of them were great mentors in their way. Bruce is sort of was famous. He passed a few years ago, but is the nicest man in neuroscience, and he was a wonderful person to work for and with, and I really miss him dearly because we had a relationship that sort of continued well past the time I was in training and up until more or less the month that he passed away. And so, very, very lucky in that regard.
Sorry to hear that he passed away.
Yep, me too. I mean, he made it to 80 and had a tremendously full life and was still thinking about science and papers almost the day he died. So, and he died very quickly. So I think, if I was looking for a way to go, dying at 80, doing things I love, is okay. But yeah, we all, there are a lot of people around. We trained, I think, 200 or 300 different people.
Oh, wow.
We mourn him intensely. Oh, he was one of the more prolific scientists in the neurosciences. I think he published around 1,500 papers in his lifetime at over several hundred, at least 100,000 citations, yeah, he was just sort of a step above like most scientists you'd ever meet. But you would never know it talking to him because he would talk to undergraduates or high school students or other postdocs or just anybody and be very engaged with whatever science they had to tell him about, and probably immediately have some contribution of his own to whatever problem they were thinking about. So he was just, yeah, wonderful human being.
So you said that you moved back to Georgia. I didn't know you still in Georgia because that's where I lived too. Yeah, I saw that you graduated with your PhD from Emory, and I only live like 30 minutes from there.
Okay, yeah. I was born in Atlanta. My mom was a graduate student at Emory at the time, and I kind of ended her PhD career because she decided to switch to being a mom, and my dad was doing his residency in neurology at Emory in 71, long ago when I was born. And then we moved to Virginia for like 10 years and then moved back when I was in middle school, high school. So lived in Buckhead area of Atlanta, and then went to Texas as Austin for college, and then back for PhD, and then New York for a postdoc. And I keep moving more northerly. If I get another job, I'll probably have to be in Quebec or something like
that. All right, back to the topic of your research. What led you to research the effect of stressful/traumatic life events?
Well, I mean, I think there are a lot of reasons. I think the immediate reason that I started looking at Bruce's lab as a place to go, and Bruce McEwen is sort of I think if there's anybody who was the father of stress neurobiology, it was him, was that the work I was doing as a graduate student in my Kuhar's lab was based around this peptide called CART peptide, which was thought to be regulated by cocaine and amphetamines because that was the focus of the lab. We were interested in psychostimulant drug abuse. But most of what I found was that it was actually regulated by corticosteroids and by stress. And so that was my sort of novel contribution as a graduate student, is that dopamine did regulate it, but not really that much or not as much as corticosterone, which is your major stress hormone, or cortisol if you're a human being. It's corticosterone's rats. That's most of who I worked with in my research career. And by like leptin and other things that are sort of metabolic signals. So that got me interested in stress. And I sort of, by that point, I was not as enamored of the psychopharmacological approach to psychostimulant or drug abuse, because it was sort of becoming apparent to me that a lot of what people who had addiction problems were dealing with was that they'd had traumatic early lives. It's not everyone who has an addiction, but it is very highly correlated with early life trauma. We have this whole ACEs or adverse childhood experiences literature, and that's based on a scale of 10 adversities you can have as a child. Things like parental divorce or physical abuse or emotional neglect, so forth. There are 10 of them, and if you check 4 or more of those boxes, actually I think it's 5 in this particular case, your risk of becoming an IV drug user in later life goes up 4,000%. So that's a huge effect in epidemiology. Like smoking for 20 years increases your risk of lung cancer by like 200%, 300%. So it's a huge signal that tells us that a lot of what we were trying to fix by finding a better, a cocaine antagonist or a better drug to treat drugs, really probably comes down to people's life history of stress. And so those two things are what drove me into Bruce's sphere, and you know, I think still motivate me now in terms of the kind of work that I do. I'm very interested in, you know, how the environment, and stress is sort of the easiest way to manipulate the environment, you know, stress or fear, because it's easy to frighten an animal or a person. You know, I mean, I laugh, and I laugh because it's not where I would like to be. You know, I don't want to stress animals out, or I don't want to cause them fear, but that circuitry is a lot easier to deal with than happiness, because it's hard to know if an animal's happy, right? You know, but you can measure startle responses, or you can measure freezing behavior in a rat, which is a common fear response in rats. And so as a consequence, we know a lot about the systems that are involved in that. And so it's an easy means to get at how the environment influences, you know, a brain. And it's sort of an endlessly fascinating one, because, you know, now I'm starting to do some theoretical evolutionary biology stuff on occasion. And stress really is a way of thinking about evolution too. You know, stress is something that, or the way I think about it now, is something that you at least perceive the need to adapt to survive, right? So it gets into like why our brains evolved the way they did, you know, why they're biased towards negative information, why we respond more to fear signals and things like that than we do to positive signals, you know. So it's something you can hang a hat on. I think it's unfortunate in the long run, you know, that that's where the science has gone, because it's easy to build a model that can work with that. We're fortunate there are people like Yak-Pang Sepp, who's also passed on, who really started to build a biology of happiness and joy and laughter in animals. He's sort of, I don't know if you've heard of him, but he's famous for his experiments tickling rats. They basically just, you know, you can get a back detector, an ultrasonic, you know, microphone, and you can get it to translate into, you know, human audible ranges. And if you tickle rats, they'll actually laugh, you know, and they'll do it to each other and things like that. So he sort of discovered that, like, these lab animals also had positive emotions, and they have positive emotional experiences. And my wife used to have pet rats as well, and I was very surprised by them when I would help before, you know, we became involved or just friends. I would come help feed rats and things like that. They were so talkative. Like, you know, normally, like, lab rats don't talk much. They're afraid. But like the pet rats, they had all sorts of vocalizations and things like that. And so there is an emerging science of, like, you know, not just rat happiness, but of, like, just neurobiology of happiness. But stress is where I found myself. So, but for a different postdoc, I might have wound up tickling rats as opposed to,
You're my first professor that I've interviewed that works with rats, so I just find you really funny.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's on a certain level kind of hilarious, and also, like, very, I mean, people have very wildly different reactions to rats. I mean, you know, lab rats in particular, like, are really docile animals. You can put them in your pocket and scratch their heads. They're not like street rats, so. Yeah, I find it very cute, you know, but I imagine some people would find it kind of repulsive, because you're like, laughing rats, that's frightening, but I think it's cool to laugh.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah.
So I know for all your studies that you use rats to, like, test your methods on, what is it about, like, rats' brain that allows scientists to be able to use it to analyze the effects of, like, in your case, stress on it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question, and to some extent, I think it's kind of the question right now, and it's one that I ask myself more and more often is, you know, what is the utility of rat, not just of rat, the rat model, but the mouse model, because those are the two common ones in neuroscience right now. And I think it's kind of limited. You know, we can show that certain basic phenomena happen, you know, that, you know, if you have an increase in stress hormones, then you can regulate this gene in this brain region or whatever. I think they're actually a lot less useful than most of my peers think in terms of modeling how humans respond to the things. Because we've spent now, 40 or 50 years doing rat neuroscience research, and we really understand quite well the genetics of rat and mouse brains and how rat and mouse neurons work. But as that's been happening in parallel, we've realized that primate brains, and specifically human brains, are actually much more different than we thought. You know, the sort of conceit that we had was that, you know, well, you know, everything's kind of conserved phylogenetically between rats and primates. You know, the brain cells are the same, like, there's nothing really different there. But it's emerged in the past 10, 20 years that, in fact, the way primate brains are organized is actually quite different from rodent brains. And, you know, primate brains, our neurons don't get bigger as our skull capacity gets bigger, whereas rodents, it basically scales to body size. So, you know, a capybara neuron is larger proportionally than a rat neuron, which means that as they grow larger, they don't actually pack in more processing capacity or not as much. Similarly, the ratio of neurons to glia, so the number of actual processing cells, although it, you know, to support cells, although glia do processing too, but in primates it's close to 1-to-1, and it's much more skewed towards glia in rodents. And so what that tells you is that a primate brain is evolved in a way that it can actually process a lot more with the same, you know, piece of brain tissue than a rodent brain can. So that by itself should tell us that primate brains are different and human brains are different. And then if we look at recent evolution and say the dorsal upper prefrontal cortex, which is a really important piece of cortex in terms of how we make decisions, and, you know, prefrontal cortex in general is sort of where we do our working memory tasks. It's if we're having a conversation with ourselves in our head, that's largely the prefrontal cortex that's driving that in a sense. And that's the most humanized part of our bodies, like is our frontal cortex. It's the most expanded piece of human anatomy, basically. And that's got at least 1,500 different transcripts or, you know, RNAs that are produced in it that are distinct to humans. We had a paper on this now probably 5 or 6 years ago with some collaborators. And so a lot of those show up enriched in people who developed the diagnosis of schizophrenia. So there's something unique about human brains. And this is an old hypothesis that schizophrenia in particular might be a disease of humanity, and that there's something about having the capacities that humans do that increases the risk of having that particular disorder, which means it would be maybe even impossible to actually accurately model it in another species that's not close to us. And, you know, I think with depression and PTSD, it's easier because, you know, obviously animals can be traumatized, animals can be low on a social hierarchy, and it can exhibit a lot of the same physiology that rats do or other primates do, but and humans do, but there's some really hard lines in there. And as I say, we've spent 40, 50 years working on that stuff. And in terms of all the recent psychiatric drugs that have come out, you know, those are ketamine, psilocybin, things like that, that basically have emerged completely from human testing, not from rodent models at all. So I'm very cautious about it, you know, and I'm made more cautious by some work that we've been doing recently with collaborators at University of Richmond and here at Tufts with wild rats. And you should talk to my collaborator Kelly Lambert at some point. She's great. She actually at some point she did an experiment. She trained rats to drive tiny cars. So they can do some human like things. I don't think she trained them to curse in traffic, but at least they can drive sort of. But she and I and some other collaborators have been starting to look at wild animals and specifically wild rats. And one of the most remarkable findings there is that wild rats show 10 or more times higher stress hormones when you capture them than have ever been observed in lab rats. So, but if you keep them captive over time, their levels of stress hormones go down. So they adapt to it, which means the range of their stress responses may be 10 times larger than our lab rats. And that means something really important in terms of what stress does in the brain of an animal that's living out in the wild and its natural environment, because, you know, rats, their natural environment is our environment too, but is very different physiologically. And in addition, their brains are 30% larger for body size than lab rats are. So they have bigger brains. There's more vasculature, so they have more fuel to those brains from their vascular system, from the blood. And a number of other things that we're really just starting to understand, like this is all stuff that we've been doing the past couple of years. So I think we're really kind of moving into a space, or at least to me, what's interesting as far as rodent neuroscience and neuroscience more generally, is that we've built all these tools with rodents. So we understand really well how the brain works under very controlled conditions. And now we can start exploring how environments build brains, you know, and I think that's going to be really exciting, because I think it's going to really change the way we think about brains, because we have, and biology in general, because we sort of have, particularly out in the popular level, like we have this view of genetics is very deterministic, but the more we know about it, the less deterministic it is. And the more we look at things like wild rats, the more we see that there you can get wildly different phenotypes that are probably being driven as much by how the genome's interacting with the environment and by the environment itself as they are by any kind of sort of determined genetic thing. You know, everyone uses the sort of Mendelian examples of like, well, if you have, two red flower genes, and then you're going to have red flowers. And, you know, and if you have two wrinkled pea genes, then you're going to have wrinkled peas. But like most genes don't work that way, particularly the ones that are interesting with regard to human intelligence and cognition. So, or even rat intelligence, cognition, because rats are smarter than they think they are. Well, actually, I shouldn't describe that prejudice to you, but many people don't think much of rat intelligence, but rats are not dumb. I think it's a really interesting and complicated question right now, that, and I think the way we think about rodent models is, I hope, is going to change pretty substantially in the next 10, 15 years.
Correct. And like you explained earlier, the difference between the primate and rodent brains, what would be, if the field does somehow change up, like, what models they use for, especially like your field, neuroscience, and testing that, what animal do you think you could be able to test on, but wouldn't violate, like, ethics?
Well, yeah, it's challenging because, like, you probably want to use a primate because for some things, because it's going to be more like a human. I think we also do just need to know more about what wild rodents are like, because maybe there are things in there that we'll learn from them that allow us to use rodents more effectively to model human mental disorders and stress-related disorders. Because I think we've bred rats for now thousands of generations to live in a non-environment, in a plastic box where nothing ever changes, and to tolerate us picking them up and changing their cages and stuff like that, which is not normal for rats. And, in fact, I would say that lab rats and lab mice are unique organisms that they're only the only organisms that exist on Earth probably that have been trained for essentially a non-environment, because we're trying to control for the effects of environment to the extent we've removed as many of them we can possibly do in sustained life. And so they're just very different animals. We have actively evolved them into something that's not really a rat anymore. I don't even know if lab rats are a model of wild rats, much less people. But I think looking at the differences is going to tell us a lot about how those models can be used. And then more to your question, though, like we're thinking about that a lot. We had a trip a year or so ago to Madagascar with Patricia Wright, sort of the queen of the lemurs. We did some work, sort of cognitive work, with mouse lemurs, which are about the same size as a mouse, as the name suggests. And they are way smarter than laboratory rodents, either rats or mice. They can solve cognitive tasks like on the first trial, which you almost never see happen with a rodent. And so they're a potential model. But they're still challenging, and it's still, hard to, in a certain way, they're super cute and I'm like, you don't want to work with them, rats are cute too, but something like the mouse lemur might emerge as a good model because it is very close to humans. But again, I think a lot of it comes down to the choice of like, what is the question you're studying? Like we have another project with Liliana Dvalos at Studio Stony Brook, where we're looking at shrew brains, because shrews, or the Eurasian shrew, basically its brain can shrink up to 30% during the winter and then go back. And so that phenomenon by itself in that animal is really interesting. It's not something humans could do, but if we could figure out how they do it, it obviously could be pretty substantially important to people who have brain injuries or dementia or whatever. If we can grow back the brain that you've lost to Alzheimer's or to a head injury or something like that, that's pretty substantial. So, the choice of models, it's pretty complicated, and it sort of very much depends on what are you trying to do with it. And so the shrew stuff, we're just working in cell culture right now to figure out what the mechanisms are, and then hopefully we can port that over to an animal where we can stage it and show that we can, maybe in a rat that doesn't normally do that, we can show that that can happen. And then you sort of move up and would do some primate testing, and then pie in the sky in 20 years, perhaps we might be able to help someone grow some brain back after they've been injured or, had a brain tumor or something like that. So yeah, I think it just requires a lot of thinking about things, but then, that's what's fun about science, is to get to think about things and get your ideas out, so.
Okay, so this is more a general question and you can interpret how you want. How do you think psychology and education are correlated and or interconnected?
You mean psychology is a research discipline or just individual psychology?
Either or.
Well, I mean, obviously, I mean, one of my big undergraduate class that I teach is learning and memory. And that's a psychology core class for a reason. And it's a concern, not only in psychology, but philosophy, going back to, you know, Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, like what are memories and how do they form us? And so I think, you know, psychology is really important in education, and that, you know, we know that, you know, there are certain ways of learning things that are better, you know, in terms of your ability to hold on to those memories. You know, like if you, you know, make sure you study a little bit every day is much better than cramming the night before, you know, and sleeping is really important for memory consolidation so that things stay with you. But also just sort of like the emotional context, you know, more to the kind of stress stuff that I do, you know, that you're more likely to remember things that share the emotional context you're in a particular moment. So if you've had a bad day, you're more likely to remember bad things that have happened to you. Or, you know, if it's just factual information for a test, maybe you'll just remember the really depressing parts of the book that you read for your class. And you won't remember the interesting or fascinating parts because those are not mood congruent with where you are. So I think psychology has a lot to say about, you know, how education works and you know, and being thoughtful about applying what psychology has learned and neuroscience has learned over the years about how learning works is really important to an effective education. I mean, that's one of the things that I like about teaching at UMass, because we have, you know, we're over 51% are first in their family to go to college. And part of what I see my role in that particular class is teaching people who didn't have a college educated family, who no one really learned to study, that's a set of skills you can pick up. It's not about being smart or dumb. It's about applying a certain set of skills effectively, you know. And the happiest I've been, you know, as an undergraduate professor has been when I run into someone 2 years later or something like that, and they tell me that, like, oh yeah, like that really changed the way I studied, and like my grades got a lot better after that class, you know, because you taught me something useful, you know. And I don't think I get to everyone in the class, but like at least if I'm getting to some people and the rest of their college experience is easier and more like just more comprehensible to them, because, you know, otherwise it's, I think so many people are acculturated right now to screens and stuff like that and looking at their phone. And like one of the things I, you know, bring across there is it's much better to just kind of write down actual notes. And, you know, if you want to learn neuroanatomy, actually get a neuroanatomy coloring book and do it, because you're doing depth of processing. You're using multiple senses and motor systems to remember this stuff. Whereas if you just keep looking at a picture of the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex again and again and again on the internet, it's just not going to make any impression, you know? So that would be my screed on how psychology contributes to education, or how they interact, at least in my experience.
And then, so what are epigenetic marks and how can they change sensitive brain regions such as the hippocampus?
So epigenetic marks just categorizes all the sort of molecular ways in which DNA can be altered in its functional availability for transcription. So, you know, there's sort of three big classes that we would sort of qualify as epigenetic marks. And there are histone modifications. And so histones are the proteins that package DNA. And so there are there are more than 100 different modifications of those, where you stick on a methyl group or an acetyl group or different chemical modifications or a serotonin even in some cases, to a specific residue or amino acid of those, and those change the way those histones interact with DNA in such a way that, in the most general sense, if you get more acetyl groups, for instance, it tends to push the histones apart, which makes the DNA more available, or various enzymes like polymerases to make RNAs with and stuff like that. If you put methyl groups on there, because methyl groups are hydrophobic, it tends to draw them together, and so it compacts the DNA. And so, like, whenever you've seen a picture of an actual chromosome, you know, from mitosis, that's all been heterochromatinized. So it's heavily methylated histones and heavily methylated DNA, because it's very compacted, so it can get moved around without breaking up the DNA, which would obviously damage it and put you at risk of cancer or just a dead cell because you missed half a chromosome or something like that. So, but during interphase, when a cell is doing something with its DNA as opposed to just dividing, you don't see those structures. That's because most of it is kind of just flopped out into a more relaxed form called euchromatin that has much less concentration of methyl groups, both on the DNA and on the histones. So it's more relaxed and all this machinery can get to it. You can make mRNA, which then helps the cell make proteins, which helps the cell be whatever kind of cell it's supposed to be. It's wrong. And then sort of the third class of thing is you have non-coding RNA. So like it turns out that only about 2 to 5% of our genome actually codes for what we would normally think of as genes. So things that code for RNA that makes protein. The rest of it is repetitive elements and non-coding RNA, and the amount of it that's we know is non-coding RNA, and non-coding RNA is sort of, I would define it as those pieces of RNA that don't code for protein but do code for an RNA that does something. So then there, I think the last time we wrote a paper on this, were about 18 different functions we identified that that non-coding RNA could do, most of which centered around regulating DNA transcription and stuff like that. But there are at least 100,000 identified non-coding RNA genes in the human genome now, and they're out of a possible maybe 4 million is the upper bound theoretically possible on that, and there are 22,000 protein coding genes in your genome. So non-coding RNA represents like a layer of complexity that I think most people even within the sciences aren't really aware of in terms of gene regulation and things like that. There's a lot more going on with non-coding RNA just in terms of numbers of different units than there is with the genes that everyone gets so focused on, which is another reason I sort of think that we're going to change the way we think about genetics, is that the genome's just a lot more complicated at that level. And so these three things, this chromatin modification or histone modification, DNA modification, where you're sticking on methyl groups to DNA, although you can stick other things on the DNA too, and non-coding RNA, ultimately they sort of decide what the cell is, you know. A big part of how we develop in, as an organism, or any organism develops, is where we decide to turn off a piece of the DNA, because every cell in our body has essentially the same DNA sequence. So the reason we're not a pile of cancer is because we shut down certain sequences of DNA in, say, a muscle cell, and shut down different ones in, say, a neuron. And so that's all epigenetic in nature. All those structures are epigenetic. And so epigenetics basically determines what individual cells are and stably over time. So like when we develop, we're using epigenetic mechanisms to develop, you know, a brain or our whole body. And then stress happens to interact with a lot of these mechanisms, and it can actually alter that programming. We know that epigenetic mechanisms, these marks, are involved in certain types of long-term memory as well. So there's something about moving around on these marks on the DNA that helps encode memories, probably through changing the structure of the neurons that are involved and the networks of neurons that are involved, like that higher order stuff. We haven't really integrated all of it yet, but we definitely, it's a big element in how we form memories. It's a big element in sort of how our brains adapt to our environments, you know. And it tends to be, you know, this is why I emphasize this developmental aspect, is that there's a lot more play in that system earlier in life, you know, like babies are more flexible than 80-year-olds, right? And adolescents are more flexible, you know, brains like yours are a lot more flexible and interesting than mine at age 50-something, you know. So, but that also means on the obverse side that if you're go through a really challenging childhood and you don't have like the right kinds of supports, that could lead you to adapting into a kind of environment that once you grow up, at least if you live in most of the Western world and, you know, actually a lot of the developing world now, where you're not really threatened with death day to day, and you're not in a violent environment, most people, you know, are nice enough, you know, then your reactions to people will be mismatched with your environment, and you'll show up with having a, you know, a personality disorder, or however we choose to categorize that now. And that'll make your life more challenging, because you're conditioned by violent, for instance, childhood, to view other human beings, because your parents, for instance, were violent, as dangerous, in a way that if you had a good childhood that was supportive, you would never have that kind of stuff. And so people who get that kind of programming in early life, they carry it into adulthood, and then, you know, then their relationships are tinged and made more difficult by the fact they have to overcome through therapy or just experience of someone who's really loving and accepting of them, the fact that they really are looking for violence out of other human beings all the time, right? So that kind of developmental programming is really important. I think it's what everybody's trying to actually get at, whether we're trying to treat psychiatric disease and things like that, is like, how do we reverse that? And it's interesting too, if there was a great paper from Kerry Ressler's lab now over 10 years ago, where they looked at people who had PTSD after they had an adverse childhood versus people who just got PTSD as adults. And they found that epigenetically they were completely different groups of people. So, and it's long been known that childhood adversities increases your risk of PTSD, but it seems that like that childhood PTSD is a different beast at an epigenetic level than the PTSD that people develop, say, after they had a car crash and they're a victim of crime or something like that as an adult, but had an otherwise healthy childhood, which if you step back and think about that introspectively, makes sense. You know, if you had a wonderful family life and your life was good, and then this horrible thing happened, but then your family was there for you and telling you you're going to get better and, you know, that things are fine and your life goes back to that normal, it's a lot easier to kind of move through that, which is not to say that PTSD is easy to get over, but it's a different lift to do that than if your family of origin was dangerous and then you have a dangerous thing to happen to as an adult. That's reinforcing everything that you've experienced before, and that makes it more challenging. And in fact, that's why, you know, in Europe, there's now this diagnosis of complex PTSD that sort of takes that into account for people who've either had very traumatic childhoods or have experienced sort of lengthy periods of torture, for instance, as opposed to a single traumatic event, because it's changed their biochemistry and how their brains are structured in more lasting and deep ways than just a car crash might, you know, which is a common cause for PTSD and folks in the Western world, because we fortunately don't have a lot of war and violence, relatively speaking.
And then, so also in a lot of your articles that are published, you talk about how the hippocampus is the one that's more susceptible to changes of epigenetic marks. Could you explain why that is?
Yeah, I mean, some of the answer is I don't know why it's more susceptible, but the simple reason is that the hippocampus is very susceptible to stress, and it's susceptible to the kind of things that cause brain weathering and dementia and things like that. You know, if you get Alzheimer's, the function of your hippocampus and your frontal cortex, those are two of the areas that start to go first. Other parts of your brain may stay pretty much normal in function across the development of Alzheimer's disease, for instance. But the reason that the hippocampus is so stress sensitive is it has a lot of receptors for stress hormones. And on top of that, it also is very tightly energetically regulated. So there have been studies now going back 10, 20 years showing the hippocampus is kind of uniquely like at an edge in terms of what you can do with sort of electrical activity in a brain region. And that if you push it too far, it's prone to developing seizures and excitotoxicity. So you can lose neurons or you can have seizures. Hippocampal seizures or temporal lobe seizures are actually quite common. So it's a pretty delicate brain structure. It's kind of operating at its limit. And it's very stress sensitive in part because it's very important to remember stressful memories, because those are probably things that were related to your survival. And so you want to encode those more deeply. So we enhance that kind of learning. You know, but you can go over that and you can overwhelm it, right? So people will kind of like, they'll lose memory of extremely stressful experiences because they're so overwhelmed by stress hormones and glutamate and things like that, that the hippocampus just sort of stops working, you know? And so for those reasons, it's just a very sensitive region in terms of those kinds of insults. And also because it is where we're laying down or encoding our long-term memories. And so it's really interesting from the epigenetic perspective in that, you know, if you think that epigenetics governs the underlying machinery that determines how we remember things and, you know, how we build spines and on dendrites and build connections within neurons, which is kind of what we call a connectionist model in neuroscience, is the dominant way we think about how memories are formed. Those connections have to be built somehow, and those are driven by epigenetic changes. And in the hippocampus, because you're so stress sensitive, you're more likely to see those changes. And in fact, that's what me and a number of other people have observed, is that the hippocampus seems to show a lot more visible epigenetic change in response to stress or fear conditioning than most other brain regions. The amygdala lights up too, but the hippocampus seems particularly sensitive.
Well, that's why when like students or even college graduates, whenever they're very stressed out, it impacts their ability to learn and form memories of that specific information.
Yeah. And again, you know, teaching students who are first in family and often have to be caregivers or have to have jobs and things like that in my work as an undergraduate teacher. Yeah. And you can see it, you know, these are people who like would love to be engaged, but like they're taking, you know, 12, 15 hours of coursework and they're trying to work a 40-hour job. And then maybe their mom's sick and then they have to miss some school to take care of a parent or something like that. And that stress really affects you, you know, and it is harder to remember when you're stressed out, you know, or when we have stress hormones circulating in our bodies, we tend to get kind of tunnel vision and we focus on the things that are threatening to us. And it's harder to kind of step back and just focus on whatever boring textbook you're supposed to read. You know, there's actually some thinking that we have you know, stress is kind of viewed as like an emergency life stage where you're paying attention to the thing that's threatening and you're very focused in on that and remembering how, you know, if you survive it, remembering how you survive. So through that's adaptive. But there are different states of mind, you know, say when you're a little bit hungry and you're in a foraging mode, when you're more likely to open up and look around at things as an animal or a human being. That's why it's really, I hate teaching class right after lunch because no one's in foraging mode. Like they're all ready for a nap, you know. But a little earlier in the day, they're a little bit hungry. They're a little more, their brain's a little more engaged, you know. And you can have that kind of openness to new experience and to novelty and things like that. Whereas when you're under stress, you know, or you want to go to sleep because you just had a big meal, you don't have the capacity to sort of pay attention to fine detail and to kind of relax and, you know, take ideas apart and things like that. And so stress is a huge part, I think, of why we have, you know, educational disparities in this country and most countries, is that the people who show up with the greatest disparity are often the people who are under the most stress due to poverty or racism or whatever, you know, and stress objectively affects your ability to encode long-term memories, which is kind of what you're doing when you're in college or high school, is you're just laying down long-term memories about the things you're supposed to learn. And if you're stressed out, you're just...
Hi guys, and welcome back. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did and learned a little bit more about the neuroscience behind cortisol and how that affects us, especially while we're pursuing our higher education. Thank you so much again to Dr. Richard Hunter for participating in this podcast, and I hope you guys have a good rest of your morning, afternoon, night, evening, wherever you're listening to this podcast, and I'll see you next time.